It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper handy, just in case there's something you hear that you might want to note for later action. Web page you want to write down, some kind of action you want to take. So let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, the solstice, December 21st, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Happy solstice. We will finish out the year at this sweet spot of a park, one of our county's crown jewels, the Sandhills. I hope you are enjoying the last of our fall weather, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed for showers that are very much needed. We will be continuing our yearly restoration efforts at the ranch, removing invasive non-native French broom. There will be lots of work repulling broom in multiple sites due to the persistent seed bank throughout the park. Here are the directions to Quail Hollow. Go up Graham Hill Road from Santa Cruz as you come down into Felton. Take the first right at the light and go up East Ziandi Road for a couple of miles. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road. The park entrance is on the right about a half a mile up. Meet in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They wear green or shine. It's probably going to be shiny but cool. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and some water. Once again, that's this Saturday, December 21st, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. If you have any questions, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number is 831-462-4041. Or you could email her at redwoodrn@packbell.net. That's REDWDRN at packbell.net. Or visit their webpage at www.cruisecnps.org. And Chinook salmon return to Marin. Coho might not be that far behind in this story by Mark Prado of the Marin Independent Journal. For the first time in 5 years, Chinook salmon are being seen in the Lagunitas watershed, a hopeful sign that federally endangered coho salmon will have a strong run this winter. Chinook salmon, also known as king salmon, are not always spotted in Marin's creeks, but when they do, they are generally accompanied by a strong run of coho. What we have seen is that when resident coho populations do well, we see other species doing well, said Eric Ettlinger, aquatic ecologist for the Marin Municipal Water District. The Chinook salmon are native to the Central Valley, but seem to have lost their way and ended up in Lagunitas Creek, Ettlinger said. It's possible they were spawned in a hatchery and they don't know where home can be found. The Chinook and coho salmon generally return to the streams in which they were born after returning from the ocean. These may not have a strong homing instinct, Ettlinger said. Marin's Chinook salmon numbers are not great. About 10 fish and 8 fish nests have been spotted. Nonetheless, it has been a pleasant surprise for those who manage the sensitive watershed. It's exciting to see them back, said Greg Andrew, fishery program manager, noting that Chinook can get to be up to 3 feet in length, bigger than the coho, which only grow to about 2 feet. It's been a few years since they have been here. Chinook were consistent visitors between 2002 and 2008, but had virtually vanished since then. It's unclear if there ever was a historic population of Chinook in Marin. What everyone is waiting for now is the return of the coho, which were said to be in an extinction vortex after its numbers slipped to all-time lows 4 years ago. But numbers have been on the rise since then. December rains help to facilitate the return of the coho from the sea to their spawning grounds. The coho complete a 3-year life cycle that sees them born, travel to the open sea, then almost miraculously return to spawn and die. We are in need of rain for a whole host of reasons, and the coho would definitely benefit, Andrew said. Rains help swell the main stem of Lagunitas Creek and its tributaries, allowing the coho more areas in which to spawn. Without the rain, coho are left to spawn only in the main stem of the creek, meaning eggs can get washed away if heavy rains come later in the winter, Edlinger explained. He expects it will be a good year for coho. Rain or no rain, we'll probably start seeing coho within the next couple of weeks, Edlinger said. Once the rain really starts falling, we're expecting more coho salmon to return to Lagunitas Creek than we've seen in the last 7 years. And Oregon police target a double blockade with sweeping arrests in this story from the Earth First Newswire. 17 activists were arrested Monday night, and after being held in jail in Grants Pass, Oregon, were bailed out on Tuesday after a double blockade of the Omega Morgan megalode heading through eastern Oregon to the Alberta tar sands. The first blockade went up around 7:30 p.m. Monday. The passenger seat of a car was removed and there was a hole cut into the floor. Air was deflated from the tires. Once the car was in place on the road, one individual crawled beneath the car and the other sat in the passenger seat area. These two individuals were locked together through a hole in an L-shaped lockbox. When police arrived on the scene, they smashed the glass of the car, then used the jaws of life to cut the car apart. They dragged the two individuals to an ambulance, still locked together in the L-shaped lockbox. Police aggressively arrested three other individuals serving as the support team who are actively trying not to obstruct the load or police activity. Arrestees reported that the police were using pain compliance holds to remove the individuals from the car and are experiencing minor injuries such as bruised wrists. The scene was cleared and the car was towed by about 8:10 p.m. At around 8:30, another blockade was deployed on Highway 26, 1.5 miles east of John Day, Oregon. This blockade included a 6-foot trailer in the middle of the road with its tires also deflated. On the trailer was a barrel of cement. One individual was locked to this barrel with their arm inside a lockbox and encased in cement. Another individual was locked to the axle of the trailer. At this blockade, in addition to the two people who were locked to the trailer, there were 9 additional arrests of individuals on the side of the road who were not trying to obstruct the load or police activity. Other individuals were unable to get close enough to find out how the police dismantled this blockade without also being threatened with arrest. In a statement, the Cascadia Forest Defenders declared, two people were locked down to a barrel and were removed from their lockdowns with pain compliance. They were tortured. Arrestees confirm reports of pain compliance techniques used in the dismantling of this blockade. According to bystanders, the police lifted and pulled the trailer, and the person locked to the axle was dragged along the ground. Another individual had her jacket sleeves cut off, which caused her to be exposed to the extreme cold while she was locked down. Tuesday, the Oregon Department of Transportation waived all public safety by allowing the megalode to travel during the day. The dangerous 900,000-pound, 376-foot-long, 22-foot-wide megalode is ordinarily scheduled to travel only during the evening due to its enormous size and slow travel rate of 10 to 25 miles per hour during the day. A similarly sized load toppled Tuesday evening in Gladstone, Oregon, and tied up Interstate 205 for 2 hours. According to Oregon Department of Transportation's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding, the megalode is traveling during the day because of frost. Activists suggest that the real reason is because of the continued intervention of protesters all along the route. This action was the latest in a series of protests that have erupted in Oregon and Washington since the megalode began to move. The load was first blocked on December 1st when two people locked themselves to the truck as an estimated 70 others rallied nearby, including Umatilla tribal members. The next night, one Umatilla tribal elder was arrested while blocking the load. 2 weeks ago in Fife, Washington, members of the Rising Tide occupied the megalode shipper Omega Morgan's office and did so again last week in Portland, Oregon, after disrupting a meeting. The group also occupied an office of a General Electric subsidiary in Bellevue, Washington, that manufactured the equipment being shipped. The group has called for Omega Morgan and other companies to stop shipping or otherwise facilitating tar sands development. Groups organizing the protest in eastern Oregon included chapters of Rising Tide and 350.org opposed the shipments due to their ultimate goal in extracting Alberta tar sands, which would supply oil for the controversial Keystone XL and facilitate what many have called the most destructive industrial project on Earth. Umatilla tribal member Shauna Radford said, "We have responsibility for what happens on our lands, but there are no boundaries for air, and the carbon dioxide this equipment would create affects us all." The Nez Perce tribe also said no to the megalodes, and so should we, unquote. And moving down under, civil disobedience campaign shuts down a coal mine in Australia, in this story from the Northern Daily Leader via the Earth First Newswire. Anti-mining protesters have scored their biggest victory this week in a sustained campaign of civil disobedience, succeeding in temporarily shutting down a coal mine in Bagga Bree. Two activists risked their lives to scale a coal crusher in Edamitsu's open-cut coal mine and unfurl a banner reading "Protect Our Water" in English and "Water is for Everyone" in Japanese. The demonstrators were calling on the Japan Bank of International Cooperation and ANZ to cease funding both Edamitsu and Whitehaven Coal's destruction of the Laird State Forest. Police were called to the mine site, and the protesters were eventually removed from the equipment about 6 p.m. They were subsequently arrested and transported to the Narrabri police station. A spokesman for the mine said the company was concerned about the safety of people accessing a working mine site. "What these people are doing is both illegal and dangerous, and it interrupts our company and our people from doing their job and making a living," he said. He didn't say anything about carbon dioxide from coal burning. A fracking site in Manchester is blockaded with a giant wind turbine blade. Monday morning, 50 pro-renewables campaigners delivered a 56-foot-long, 1.7-ton wind turbine blade as a Christmas gift for fracking company iGas. The entrance to the Barton Moss test site in England has been blocked to prevent drilling vehicles from entering. At 5:30 in the morning on Monday, 16th of December, 50 people blockaded the entrance to iGas's exploratory drilling site in Barton Moss, England, with a giant wind turbine blade. The campaigners arrived at the site in Salford in Greater Manchester, England, proceeded to unload and assemble the 56-foot blade from its three component segments. They were spotted by a security guard who called the police, but the officers arrived on the scene were too late to prevent the blockade from being set up. The campaigners then left, leaving the heavy wind turbine blade in place across the entrance, complete with a large red Christmas bow. Currently, all vehicle access to the site is being severely disrupted by the 1.7-ton blade, which cannot be moved without large numbers of people or specialized equipment. And Russian amnesty to benefit Pussy Riot and Greenpeace 30 protesters. This story reported by Steve Gutterman, with additional reporting by Maria Zvetkova, editing by Timothy Heritage and Alistair Lyon of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced that Russia's parliament on Wednesday adopted an amnesty, which lawyers said would free two jailed members of punk band Pussy Riot and enable 30 people arrested in a Greenpeace protest against Arctic oil drilling to avoid trial. Such an outcome would remove two of many irritants in ties with the West before Russia hosts the Winter Olympics in February. Concern over Russia's treatment of gays is already threatening to cloud the atmosphere of the Sochi Games. The State Duma, or lower house, unanimously approved the amnesty proposed by President Vladimir Putin to mark the 20th anniversary of a passage of Russia's post-Soviet constitution. Human rights activists say the amnesty is far too narrow, freeing only a fraction of Russia's more than 500,000 prisoners. It will not benefit prominent Putin foes such as jailed tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky or opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who will be kept out of elections for years by a theft conviction he says was politically motivated. But lawyers said it would lead to the early release of Pussy Riot members Nadezhda Tolokonokova and Maria Aliokhina, whose two-year sentences over an anti-Putin protest in a Moscow cathedral have been criticized in the West as being excessive. Greenpeace said an amendment added hours before the vote would almost certainly end legal proceedings against 30 people who were jailed and faced jail terms of up to 7 years over a protest at an Arctic offshore oil platform in September, allowing the 26 foreigners among them from 17 countries to go home. "We have good news," Greenpeace Russia said on Twitter. The Duma has voted to grant amnesty to the Greenpeace activists. The rest of the men and women, dubbed the Arctic 30, also drew Western criticism and was widely seen as a signal that Putin will not tolerate efforts to stop Russia's development of the resource-rich region, where many nations are vying for clout. A lawyer for Tolokhinnikova and Alyokhina said prison terms end in March. The attorney said she hoped they would walk free within days. "It's a very narrow amnesty, but I'm very glad it applies to my clients," lawyer Irina Krunova said by telephone. The amnesty will take effect when it is published in the official government gazette, which was expected today. The Arctic 30 were arrested after Russian coast guards boarded the Greenpeace icebreaker Arctic Sunrise following a September 18th protest in which some of the activists tried to scale Russia's first offshore oil platform in the Arctic. They were originally charged with piracy, but then with hooliganism, jailed in stark conditions for 2 months and have been unable to leave Russia since they were released on bail earlier this month. "I might soon be going home to my family, but I should never have been charged and jailed in the first place, Greenpeace quoted Arctic Sunrise's U.S. Captain Peter Wilcox as saying. "We sailed north to bear witness to a profound environmental threat, but our ship was stormed by masked men wielding knives and guns. We were never the criminals here." A Greenpeace lawyer said it was unclear whether the foreigners who do not have visas could leave Russia by January 1st. Putin, accused by his critics of curbing democracy during 14 years in power and stifling dissent in his third presidential term, said last month the amnesty should underscore the humanism of our state, unquote. It would release many elderly and young people, women with young children, and people with disabilities. But members of Putin's own Human Rights Council estimate it will free fewer than 1,500 convicts. Almost all Russian trials end in convictions, and the prison population is nearly 700,000 in Russia. Critics also say it could lead to the release of some police, soldiers, and government bureaucrats charged with crimes, but will leave in jail people accused of violence against the police, including protesters at an anti-Putin rally last year. And Central Florida's suburban sprawl is bumping into bears. They're reported by Barbara Liston, editing by David Adams, and Peter Cooney, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Guess who's coming to dinner? In the leafy far suburbs of Orlando, Florida, the uncomfortable answer increasingly is a Florida black bear. Calls about bears, including reports of sick or injured ones, more than quadrupled in Florida over the past decade, according to statistics maintained by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. In 2012 alone, the commission received 6,159 calls, an average of 17 a day. More than half of actual complaints have come from Central Florida, where urban sprawl has brought more people into former wilderness areas near or adjacent to the 600-square-mile Ocala National Forest, fracturing bear habitat there and plopping homes alongside long-established bear trails. At the same time, the state bear population has rebounded to more than 3,000 from the several hundred in the 1970s, thanks to measures to protect them from extinction, according to the state's Fish and Wildlife Commission. A bear attack on a Longwood, Florida woman walking her dogs last Monday evening, though a rare occurrence, focused attention on both the perils and wonder of coexisting with wildlife. Susan Chalfant, 54, told neighbors who found her bleeding profusely from the head that she did not see the bear that knocked her to the ground. "They're in backyards here on the main roads as well as the deer. It's a wonderful sight to see just 10 or 15 miles from downtown Orlando," said Emil Skip Scipponi, community association manager for the Springs, a nearby subdivision. Scipponi said all new residents at the Springs went through an orientation that includes education about living with black bears. "The key to successful coexistence is to avoid feeding the bears, even inadvertently." Bears helping themselves to the remains of a fast food meal in trash cans and exposed refrigerators in garages or to unprotected crops account for more than 40% of calls to state and lead directly to worse encounters later, wildlife officers said. They're big, they're hungry, they're smart animals, and like many of us, they will take the path of least resistance. If food is left out for them, they will eat a feast and become habituated, said Lori McDonald, director of the Florida Chapter of Defenders of Wildlife. Bears can smell food from over a mile away and will travel great distances to track down the source of a tempting odor. The calories a bear can consume by picking through one garbage can often surpasses the forage they can find in an entire day, wildlife officials say. Nancy Payton, a field representative for the Florida Wildlife Federation in Naples, Florida, gets calls weekly from new homeowners, many of whom bought relatively inexpensive homes in the interior of the state and are surprised by the sight of a bear in their backyard. It never occurred to them they were moving into a wildlife area, Payton said. It's quite a shock. Of course, they want us to come take the bear away, but there's no place to take them. Payton said she was having some successes encouraging developers in southwest Florida, where panthers are a bigger issue, to raise awareness, including wildlife coexistence plans in home buyer documents. Some developers consider the wildlife a marketing tool for what they call a green community, she said. But ultimately, home buyers are responsible for understanding what they are moving into, Payton said. I think it's more of the burden of due diligence for the prospective home buyer, just like you would check out the school, she said. Literally half the time I go out, I see a bear if there is a moon, said Richard, one of Chalifant's neighbors and rescuers who talked with reporters about the incident on condition his last name be withheld for privacy. Whereas screams in the night might signal a crime in progress to an urban resident, Chalifant's shrieks of terror meant only one thing to Richard. Obviously, I thought of a bear and a bear attack, he said. He was one of those who purchased a house in bear country unawares and later bought dogs to protect his home. State wildlife officers have yet to determine whether the bear that slashed Chalifant was startled and reacted defensively, as in most human-bear encounters, or sought her out. A 200-pound female bear trapped 2 days later in the area and suspected of being Chalifant's attacker was euthanized, a common outcome for bears showing aggression around people. And newer wind turbines are still killing hundreds of thousands of birds in this story by Robert Johns of the American Bird Conservancy at their website ABC Birds. A new study shows that despite updated designs, U.S. wind turbines are killing hundreds of thousands of birds annually, a number that may balloon to about 1.4 million birds killed per year by 2030, when the ongoing industry expansion being encouraged by the federal government is expected to be fully implemented. The findings were issued in a new study by scientists at the Smithsonian Institution Migratory Bird Center, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Oklahoma State University, published in December issue of the journal Biological Conservation, authored by Scott Loss of OSU, Tom Will of the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, and Peter Mara of the Smithsonian. The study, estimates of bird collision mortality at wind facilities in the contiguous United States, was based on a review of 68 studies that met rigorous inclusion criteria and data derived from 58 bird mortality estimates contained in those studies. The studies represented both peer-reviewed and unpublished industry reports and extracted data to systematically estimate bird collision mortality and mortality correlates. The life expectancy for eagles and all raptors just took a big hit. Clearly, when you look at this study and you consider the new 30-year eagle take permits just announced by the Department of Interior, this is a bad month for this country's iconic bird, said Dr. Michael Hutchins, National Coordinator of the American Bird Conservancy's Bird Smart Wind Energy Campaign. According to George Fenwick, president of ABC, this study by top scientists said that hundreds of thousands of birds are being killed by the wind industry now, and that the number will escalate dramatically if we continue to do what we have been doing. The biggest impediment to reducing those impacts continues to be wind industry siting and operating guidelines that are only followed on a voluntary basis. The status quo is legally as well as environmentally unstable, Hutchins said further. The federal government is seeking to promote an energy sector in a manner that is in violation of one of the premier federal wildlife protection statutes. In December of 2011, we formally petitioned the Department of Interior to develop mandatory regulations that will safeguard wildlife and rewards responsible wind energy development. We continue to believe that is the solution. A coalition of more than 60 groups has called for mandatory standards and bird smart principles in the siting and operation of wind energy installations. The coalition represents a broad cross-section of respected national and local groups. In addition, 20,000 scientists, ornithologists, conservationists, and other concerned citizens have shown their support for mandatory standards for the wind industry. According to the American Bird Conservancy, poorly sited and operated wind projects pose a serious threat to birds, especially birds of prey such as bald eagles, golden eagles, hawks and owls, endangered and threatened species such as California condors and whooping cranes, and species of special conservation concern such as Bicknell's thrush, cerulean warblers, tricolored blackbirds, Sprague's puppets, and the long-billed curlew. One particularly interesting finding of the new study concerned the height of turbines. Scientists found that bird collision mortality increased significantly with increasing hub height. Across a range of turbine heights from 36 to 80 meters, the study predicts a staggering tenfold increase in bird mortality. This is especially important because the study identifies an important trend toward increased turbine heights. The new study comes just after the Department of Justice announced a settlement on the prosecution of Duke Energy's wind developments in Wyoming in connection with the deaths of 14 golden eagles and 149 other protected birds. That first-ever settlement resulted in a $1 million fine and mitigation actions and was the first prosecution of a wind company in connection with bird mortality. If you'd like further information, go to the American Bird Conservancy website, www.abcbirds.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and we are back on the air. Or you can tune into our web stream at www.freakradio.org. If you are in Moscow, Idaho, you can listen to KRFP, rebroadcast of the Earth First Update on Monday at 9:30 p.m., their frequency 90.3 FM, which is their new frequency at higher power. If you'd like to download this broadcast as a podcast or listen online, go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.